AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 220 for November 22nd, 2013. A tour of the garage with Bruce Meyer. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Well, all of you watching right now can tell that we're not in the studio back in the Detroit area. Today we're out in Los Angeles, here for the auto show, but especially tonight because we're in Bruce Meyer's new garage. He's got a phenomenal collection here. We're going to be talking with him and about all the different, I guess I'm going to call them artifacts that he's got in here soon enough. But we're going to kick off this show with a great conversation I had yesterday with two of my colleagues right at the LA Auto Show, talking about the latest cars that we saw there, and let's go to that segment right now. Well, we're here at the Porsche display, Porsche lounge, we might call it. We're at the LA Auto Show. This is a special open for AutoLine After Hours. It's actually a little bit of a preview for an AutoLine this week that we've got coming up, because I've got two of my colleagues from the North American Car of the Year jury. And we're starting with Jack Neurath here from Kelley Blue Book and Matt DeLorenzo writing here for at the show with the Rob Report. Great having the both of you here.
Hey, so great to be with you. It's a blast to be here, isn't it?
And we're going to be talking about some of the cars that we've seen at the show and what we like or not. And as I said, this is a preview because coming up at the end of December, I'm going to have these two guys back in the studios of AutoLine talking about the finalists for the North American Car and Truck of the Year Award. But let's start with this show, and since we're in the Porsche display, what do y'all make of the Macan?
Well, it's really interesting. I'm wondering, in a way, if Porsche hasn't jumped the shark here with this thing. Because I'm wondering, at some point, when you have so many four-doors, so many SUVs in your lineup, have you changed your brand so significantly that your brand isn't what it used to be? I wonder
how... It hasn't hurt them yet, right?
Yeah,
so you're thinking
absolutely hasn't hurt them yet. I'm wondering if this is the one that
jumps the shark.
It kind of changes things.
Well, it could be a crossover too far, but certainly if you look at the Lincoln MKC and the fact that Jag has their first crossover as well, and especially since they're teamed with Land Rover, they said that they weren't going to do a crossover. The fact that they're doing a crossover, maybe not so
much. They haven't made that official, but you know they're really hinting that there's going to be a Jag crossover.
Right.
And again, what does that say for Land Rover?
Right, right. But I think if you look at the success of the Audi Q5, I think that's what everybody's sort of keying off of. And it shows how hot this market is, and if you don't get in it, you're going to lose out.
That's true, but I mean, boy, it's so interesting, to your point, Jack, to see these luxury brands going lower and lower and lower in market. You know, a Porsche that starts at least on paper at 50 grand, you know, a Mercedes that starts just under 30. Yowza, they're treading in dangerous territory, potentially.
And you can see the business case. The business case is obviously there. But what does it do to the brand? And, you know, a lot of times, if you're a car company executive, off in the future, you're not so concerned with. You're concerned with selling now, selling right away, and here's the opportunity.
Yeah, somebody once told me, in the future, we'll all be dead.
Well, I think one thing going in Porsche's favor is the fact that they're going to have the highest performing vehicle of this type. And that's true to the Porsche mission statement, that they are a true enthusiast car. So if there is somebody looking for a compact SUV that's really going to be a driver's machine, then Porsche should be the one that brings it to you.
But when you look at some of the other full-line manufacturers that have a luxury brand, it seems to me those luxury brands can stay true to the cause, true luxury, because they've got these mass-market brands, whereas, you know, well, Porsche is part of the VW group,
exactly.
So that's kind of interesting.
Right.
But when you look at, say, BMW, Mercedes, and the like, you know, to see them going down market, that's where I think the bigger risk is.
Well, it just shows how closely they shave segments, right? I mean, here's a segment, compact SUV, a compact crossover, and then they've taken it all the way up to the luxury level. It's kind of a new thing in a lot of ways, but what does it do with the brand?
I have to wonder how high up is,
right,
and where you're going to hit sort of the top of how expensive these things are, and it certainly could really affect their volume.
Right.
And that's what they need, volume out of this vehicle. You know, I heard Porsche selling 200,000 a year.
That's what they're shooting for. In fact, Walter De Silva on our show 3 years ago said that was their target.
I find that astounding.
It's a fundamental transformation of the brand, really.
Yeah.
It truly is. So was the Macan the most important intro at the LA show?
If not the most important, maybe the most newsworthy from what it's doing, you know, what it could do and the implications that it has. But I'd say another one that's really newsworthy is the Colorado midsize pickup truck. I mean, who would have thought that market would come back, right, domestically?
Well, especially since they dropped out of it. Ford doesn't seem to have any interest. Dodge doesn't either. So,
yeah, I think you could see a real resurgence in that segment. And especially among youth, you know, young guys who are very active, they don't want a full-size pickup. And it's really interesting to look at the styling of it, because you look at the styling of the full-size Silverado, and it's gotten more macho, more truck-like. I really like the style of the Colorado. It's a handsome-looking pickup.
It really is a good-looking pickup. I think they're going to do well with it if they can keep the separation between it and the full-size. And that's so critical, and I'm not sure that they have the discipline or the ability to do that.
I think they do, the OEM, but do the salespeople at the dealerships. You know how it is, you come in looking at a Colorado and they go, Jack, for an extra $15 a month, I'll put you in a real truck.
Well, and I think when push comes to shove and they need volume and the full size, and, you know, that's the bedrock of General Motors, one of the bedrocks is a full-size pickup truck. Suddenly they're going to go, well, you know, we can incentivize this. We can discount this some. And suddenly the price is right on top of the Colorado, and then the Colorado's got problems.
Yeah, but I got to believe that a compact truck like this will do killer well in Southern California.
I think it'll do well there, but also among a cohort that they may be missing are younger males. And they have nowhere to go other than the Tacoma, really, and maybe
Frontier,
the Frontier.
Right.
But there aren't a lot of places in town to get something like that, especially with the Ranger going away.
Well, I'm impressed because they've got several different body styles, three different powertrains, blah, 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 blah. It wasn't just a little pickup they put out there. They put out a family of compact trucks.
Right. And coming with the diesel is really interesting,
That's
too.
That's
fascinating. Diesel in the midsize. We'll see if they can justify that premium, because it's going to be a premium, but it also gets great, great fuel economy. So there's a big plus there.
Yeah. Okay. What else is that the show that caught you guys?
Well, I thought that AMG GT was pretty interesting. They're going to replace the SLS, obviously. They want it. Mercedes wants to go after the 911 with this vehicle. I thought it was one of the most overwrought concepts in a while.
It's horrifically bad. I'm sorry.
I just hope that the production car looks a lot better than that thing. I mean, it was just amazing that they put that out there.
To me, it looks like, you know, some cartoonist sketch that made it into the flesh, so to speak. I don't know. I didn't like any aspect of it at all.
Well, when they turn these things, sometimes they reverse engineer into a concept car. You know, they have the final production vehicle already designed, and then they go way out because it has to be conceptized, and they get weird. And I think maybe that's part of the case.
I think they got weird.
Yep.
Hey, the other thing I found interesting at the show, two fuel cell cars. You know, Hyundai showing their fuel cell Santa Fe, which looks like any other Santa Fe, and then Honda pulling the wraps off its concept for a fuel cell car.
Which doesn't look like any Santa Fe,
no.
I can tell you that. I mean, it hardly looks like a car, right? I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, yeah, the FCEV, there's several things that you can see. It's an evolution of the Clarity. I mean, there's still that roof line. And then it has sort of the skirted rear wheels that you would see at the original Insight. So it's kind of a mishmash, kind of, you know, the more I looked at it, it's funky, but I kind of liked it.
Actually, those rear fender things remind me of, if you recall, the GM Hyperlight or Ultralight.
EV1.
EV1 and even some of the Ford Probe aerodynamic studies that did back in the 80s.
Well, I think there's still this feeling that these alternative fuel or electric cars have to be different looking in a big way. They have to be futuristic, and it's like 50s futuristic. It's kind of like the Batmobile futuristic, and you kind of scratch your head, and I think what we see with Tesla Model S is, if you just make a good-looking car but make it all electric, It's going to sell like hotcakes.
That's right, but it's got to be beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the other thing. Yesterday we had an opportunity to drive the i3. And it's kind of a fun car to drive. It's really different looking. From a driving perspective, it's a great view out of it. But I'm wondering from a practicality standpoint, it really does have a high step in. It's got these weird rear hinge doors in the back to make the back seat hard to get into.
Very hard to get in the back seat.
I think they're going to sell some, but I don't know if it's a breakthrough car that they really need to build some EV volume that they need.
Now, look, none of the EVs have sold in the kind of volume that these OEMs need to make a return on that investment. But I love the i3. I thought it was a blast to drive. What I especially liked is they have a very aggressive regenerative braking. Did I say that right? Regenerative braking.
I could never say that either.
Right. Regen. There you go.
Right.
So that I had a miracle happen to me yesterday. I got on Mulholland Drive and there was no traffic for 10 minutes. And this was at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Okay, not 2 in the morning.
Right. Okay. So I'm blasting down Mulholland and it was a lot of fun going deep into turns, backing off, not having to use the brakes. I love driving that thing.
Yeah. There's a lot to like about that car, but in terms of looks, I'm with Matt.
I'm with Matt, really? Too.
Yeah, wow.
It's kind of toaster-ish, you know, from a styling standpoint.
Yeah, the brave little toaster.
Yeah.
The other interesting car here is the K900 at Kia. I was amazed at how big that car was. I mean, I saw some pictures of it and things like that.
Well, it's an Equus, right? It's an Equus with a new body on it.
Yeah, it's huge.
And it really puts the Equus on the back seat, styling-wise.
Exactly. I think and that's Peter Schreier. I think part of it is that he brings sort of an understated look to everything from his Audi days, and it serves them well. The interior was spectacular on it as well.
Well, and I think that makes a real brand statement. That's what they're trying for. I mean, they're not going to sell those in every Kia dealership. You have to qualify to sell that as a Kia dealership. And they're going to use that really to lever their dealers into a better experience. That's exactly what I've been told from the Kia folks.
I loved the grill on it. I don't know if you looked at that, but the detail in the grill is awesome. It's almost like a sort of chain link thing, but don't get an idea that it's like a chain link fence at all. It's a very fabricated looking grill, not like an injection molded one at all.
I think that's one of the big things, too, to look at a lot of these cars is they're becoming very tactile. You look at them and the quality of the materials, the workmanship. I mean, even in cars that aren't that expensive, the bar has really been raised. So, again, when you get coming back to the Macan and things like that, they have to make sure if they're going to be asking that kind of money, the interior better deliver on whatever the sticker says on the window.
I mean, it gets harder and harder for the luxury brands because the popularly priced brands are so good with so many features. You go, well, what more can it do for me? You know, it can drive itself, but they're talking about that. Well, you know, I have to wonder about that, too.
No, you're right, because I stopped by the Forcia booth. You know, Forcia is a supplier. Not many suppliers at the show, but they had this little trim piece amongst a bunch of other things that they're putting in the Golf GTI. It's aluminum. They etch it with a laser. They brush the whole thing and then paint part of it. So you see these very fine lines in there. And if you scratch your fingernail over it, you can feel it too. I'm telling you, for a little trim piece, I was knocked out at how good it looked. And it's on a Golf.
Right. The other car that I had an opportunity to drive during the show, and the manufacturers are doing more of that, was the ELR. And I was really impressed, again, with the build quality in terms of how quiet it was and how solid it was. And it really drove great. Right. And it's got the torque that you get from an EV, which makes it fun to drive. But, again, the interior on that car was executed very, very well. So I think they're going to get, you know, everybody talks, well, you know, it's $55,000, but to me, it felt like a $55,000 car.
That's all it is? I thought it was going to be $75,000.
Really?
For the ELR. That's what I thought.
The base one.
It could
be. Yeah. I think they're taking that up price-wise. And I think that's one of those, again, where it might start out here and then
end up somewhere
else. Yeah.
So what else at the show? We touched briefly on the MKC. I think this is the first auto show it's being shown at, right? Even though we've all seen it before this.
Right.
But I think it's a pretty good car. I think it's just looking at it. I haven't driven it. Should help Lincoln a lot.
I think it will help Lincoln a lot. I mean, that's such a hot segment. I mean, right behind us is another example of that, right? I mean, these compact crossovers, people like the tall height, you know, the step in, being able to see like that. So I think it's going to do well for Lincoln. Lincoln kind of quietly is accelerating a bit. I mean, they're not really heavily on the gas in terms of sales, but they're getting better and better and better, and I think they're working it. You know, they're working the plan pretty well right now.
The most interesting thing about Lincoln I noticed today, what was on their stand, they only had two product lines there, the MKC and the MKZ. There wasn't an MKT or an MKS anywhere to be seen on the stand. Now, whether or not it stays that way through the public days of the show, I don't know. But it was very telling that when I was walking through, I did not see their complete lineup.
I think that's a smart move. Why remind everybody of the old stuff? Seriously.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
when they did that last year, I mean, they had, you know, classic Lincolns.
That was
the 20s,
great
and 30s,
display.
And the 50s. And the problem is, all those cars overshadow the current Lincolns, right? I mean, they all look better than the current Lincolns. And you go, oh, that's not exactly the message we want to send. They want to send they have great heritage, but they really want to send that, hey, we've got stuff right now that you can buy and can be happy about buying it.
Jaguar introduced the F-Type Coupe here. It's a great fanfare. I can't believe the coverage that they got out of this thing, going from a convertible to a hardtop. But it does change the look of the car, and I think it makes the car look better, actually.
Well, when they originally introduced the concept, it was a coupe.
And, coupe.
A coupe. I did find it kind of interesting because that original concept had the side hinge door opening on the back and the hatch, and they went to a much more conventional lift back. But I like the glass. The glass roof is brilliant on that thing. And you can see down inside. And again, here's another one that's got a terrific interior.
Really, the best look of that car is from above. Now, I don't know how they're going to do that in the showroom unless they build second stories and you look down on it. Because that glass roof, because you have the extension of the windshield through the glass roof and then into the hatchback with the glass all the way through, is gorgeous. But it's not a look that people typically see. Right.
You're right. So second story, or maybe put mirrors up there.
Yeah, mirrors on the roof, yeah.
Right.
That can happen.
It is a business that's all about smoke and mirrors.
Right, yeah.
We're not going to go there.
Yeah.
Well, hey, guys, this is a pretty good overview. We didn't touch on every single thing, but probably the most important ones. And Jack Nierick.
Oh, thanks so much.
Matt DeLorenzo, yeah. Want
to
thank you both. And I'll see you both in about a month on Autoline.
We look forward to it.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Well, welcome back to Bruce Myers Garage with the man himself, Bruce Myers. And Bruce, thanks so much for having Autoline After Hours in your new garage.
Yep. Well, it's a pleasure. Believe me, we've been friends for a long time, and you were at my home garage the last time, and I enjoyed that as well, John.
That's what we should remind the audience about. 6 years ago, when we were doing our Autoline in L.A. series, we visited Bruce's garage, literally at the garage of his house. Now you've got this fantastic facility. What led you to do this the way that you've done it?
Well, the inspiration was I was trying to get it done for my 70th birthday. We missed that by a couple of years.
You don't look anywhere near 70, dude.
Yeah, 72. But I started my business here in 1968. So I've been here for 45 years. And this has been everything from a parking garage, the first one in Beverly Hills, to a shoe warehouse, to a catalog fulfillment center, which is what I brought to it. And I had a candle shop downstairs. This is 60s, you understand. Anyway, so, and then it's become offices and manufacturing. It's just right in the heart of Beverly Hills. It makes absolutely no sense. But I just decided at a certain point in time, you realize that, you know, you're going to leave this planet and you could leave everything for the next generation. But my plan was now I'm going to burn through it as quick as I can for my generation.
Great.
So this was an extravagance.
Great way to approach it. And you've got phenomenal cars in here. So let's get right into them.
Sure.
And this must be the Le Mans series.
This is very much the Le Mans part of the show, so to speak. Le Mans, as we all know, is the World Series, Olympic Games, Super Bowl of motorsport. And I think that. So each of these cars has some nexus to Le Mans. And the Corvette was the first Corvette to run Le Mans in 1960. And there's a photo up there starting in the second spot.
Here's the car itself, and there it is, right at the starting grid at the race.
Yeah, exactly. So it was one of three cars. They won their class. It was Briggs Cunningham, proud American, great patriot, won the America's Cup, brought the first three Corvettes to Le Mans. So that was in 60. This is 61. And 61, you know, Phil Hill was our champion. And this was driven to a class win, third overall. So it was a podium finish, third overall in 1961. And this is a very rare car. This is what they call a 250 short wheelbase CFAC, which is the acronym for factory hot rod. This is the penultimate GTO. After this car in 61, the next car out was the GTO. So this is a...
The precursor to it.
The precursor. The next car was a car that ran the trials at Le Mans, but actually didn't run the race. This is the first Cobra built. This is serial number one, and it was built in Pennsylvania and at Ed Hugus' shop. It was bought by a fellow named Lucky Kasner, who had Camerati Racing, and he wanted to run Le Mans in it. So they took it to Le Mans, ran the trials, and it actually did pretty well. But at that time, by the time they did the whole Le Mans thing, they had already come out with the FIA car, which was a 289 rack and pinion car, which would dramatically outperform this car, so they just didn't run it. Instead, they took this car to Ford Racing of Europe, which was in France, and they upgraded this to full FIA. This is a rack and pinion, 289. Those were original, you know, GT, you know, Ford Daytona Coupe wheels. And this ran right along with the Daytona Coupes. And in fact, there's a photo in the back which shows the car with the worst looking hardtop imaginable.
That's pretty boxy.
It is just awful.
Almost looks like a Mini in the back.
It is terrible, but you can see it ran with the, you know, the GTO Ferrari and the Ford Cobra Daytona Coupe, and it was the only Cobra ever to run the Tour de France. And in those days, I think the main races were Le Mans, Targa Florio, and Tour de France. Those mm-hmm. were the main, like, world competition races. And so this is the only Cobra to have run Tour de France.
Now, did these cars just become available to you? Did you go after these cars? Why these three Le Mans winners or Le Mans competitors?
Sure. Well, I don't really consider myself a collector. I think of myself as an enthusiast. And every car I have, I love as an enthusiast, as a driver. Every single one of these cars I have driven either on the track or in rallies. The Corvette we had at Goodwood. This car, 2 years ago, we ran it on the Colorado Grand 1,000 miles. Last year, we ran this 1,000 miles in Colorado. We've taken them out. We share them. We do track days. So I just pick the cars that really mean something to me or meant something to me in the period. You know how that works.
Sure.
But they also, for me, they have to, you know, kind of aesthetically appeal to me. So there's a car. We just bought a car recently. It was a Bizzarini. You know what a Bizzarini is with a Chevy engine in it?
I know of it.
Yeah. Well, this is a car that won its class at Le Mans, so it's a rare car. But I figured it would fit right in here because it's a Chevrolet engine. I've always been a very proud, patriotic guy, and at least it has some connection to Detroit. You know, the engine's from Detroit. But the car over here is another car that I think is just a stunning thing. And this is a 1929 Bentley 4.5.
4.5 liters?
4.5 liters, and they made 3 liters, 4.5, 4.5 blowers, and then they made a 6 liter, speed 6 or 6.5 liter. So these cars ruled Le Mans in the late 20s.
And the Bentley boys.
The Bentley boys, exactly right, John. And this car is a very original piece. It never turned a wheel in a race, but every single part, every bit of it is matching numbers as it came from the factory. So to find an original body, original chassis, original engine, transmission is a very hard thing to find. And so it was an opportunity that came my way. I bought it from a family that had owned it for 50 years. So that's the significance of this car. And my wife and I drove this car from Monaco to Venice, Italy, 1,000 miles over all the Alpine passes. And this last year we did the Vintage Bentley Tour, and this year we're going to do the same thing again up in Maine and New Hampshire. And so it's a car we love to drive. We've driven it to all the shows. We've had it out 3 times, and we've won 3 nice prizes with it. So it's been a fun car.
You know what? I really like what you're saying, too, is not only do you have beautiful cars in a nice garage setting, you get them out and drive them.
Do you know, they are cars, and they're special cars, and they're special for a reason, and I just love the drive. I mean, when I first started, you know, with vintage cars, I was more into the, showing them at Pebble Beach and that type of thing, and then I wouldn't drive, and I'd put it on the trailer, and even one car, first Duesenberg I showed at Pebble, we wrapped the tires so that they wouldn't get grass on them. I mean, give me a break. I mean, I don't know what I was thinking.
But you were cured of that eventually,
I was, eh? Totally, totally. So we drive every car here.
And it does them good to be driven, right? I mean, they can just rot if they just sit for a while.
They love to be driven. And especially like Gullwings, which has a dry sump motor and a lot of bits that can dry out. You know, to drive it is really, really important.
And you said you are attracted to cars that are aesthetically pleasing to you, and the Gullwing's got to be one of those right at the top of the list.
At the very top. I bought my first Gullwing in 1964. My son, who is a car guy but not an extreme car guy, likes cars, probably likes the newer ones better. This is his favorite car. So I think this is transgenerational. I mean, I think it's one of the most perfect designs ever. And it's just a beautiful thing.
And really a technical tour de force for
totally.
The car of its day.
100%, John. This is a space frame. If they'd only made 100 of these, this would be a $10 million car. But they made, 1,500, I think, or something like that. So they made a lot of them. And this car, we spent a lot. This car is an original Rudge wheel car. The engine was done by Ed Pink Engineering, who's an engine builder here in town. Steve Beckman in Newport Beach did the bodywork. We did a full rotisserie restoration on this car. And John Compton did the interior, just a beautiful job. And
gorgeous interior.
It is absolutely spec'd as it would be ordered from the factory.
Including the fitted luggage.
Yes. Yeah,
now that's very spectacular,
option.
Which
Isn't
matches the interior perfectly. And unlike most luggage that would be in the trunk, it's in the car itself,
that's
in the passenger
right. Yeah.
cockpit.
And I had this car out about... I guess 2 weeks ago we went downtown for a dinner, and you know, so we drive them. And here's another car. One of the things, I lent this car to the Peterson. They put it up on a pedestal, so I put it up on a pedestal because I think it looks so pretty. But I think this is the prettiest car I have.
And Ferrari.
Ferrari.
And which model exactly?
Yeah, this is a 1957 Testarossa, and it was bought new by John von Neumann. And here's I just love this picture of John. This is in 1957, John sitting in the car. I don't know if that's going to work well for you. But it was driven by John von Neumann, Richie Ginther, Ken Miles. Sorry about all the mess on the seat there. But it's a wonderful car. And we had this, it's very easy for us to get this off the pedestal. We had it out, we drove it out to one of those Sunday morning cars and coffee events last month. So, again, this car could start right up, and it could drive right to New York if you had to. Phil Riley, who has a wonderful restoration shop up in Corte Madera, he did the restoration on it. They're Ivan Zaremba.
Spectacular. I mean, it looks like it was just finished in the factory.
Yeah.
And another thing, another detail of your garage is you've got this giant photo of it racing.
Yeah.
In the background.
Right.
So here's the car in front of us. There it is on the track right behind us.
That's right. 1958. That's Paramount Ranch.
Where was that? In this area?
Yeah. Southern California. Paramount Ranch.
That's great.
And here, as long as we're here, we just got to talk about hot rods because that's my passion. This car, and by the way, you know, it's easier for me to brag about these cars. I had nothing to do with the build. And this is one of those cars that... The detail work, this was built by a fellow named Don Thielen for a fellow named Bob Morrison in Santa Barbara. And it's an original 32 body, chassis, everything. Pete Eastwood did the chassis, and Dan Gurney provided the engine. The fellow wanted everything Ford. So this is just one of those wonderful cars. They call it the Nickel Roadster. All the bright work is nickel. And the
is this uniquely fabricated?
This was what they call a Duval windshield.
It's the frame is beautiful. It's a work of art in itself.
I'll put a pitch in for Rodder's Journal, which is a magazine. It's kind of an architectural digest of hot rodding. But Rodder's Journal this month did a feature on the Don Spencer car, which is the oldest hot rod extant, and this car, comparing the two. I think that Steve Coonan, the publisher, did the most fabulous job. I don't know if it's okay to give him a picture.
Yeah, sure it is.
It's a wonderful, wonderful magazine.
What I love is what a variety that you've got here. Le Mans winners, you know, things from cars from the 20s, the 50s, your own custom hot rod, too.
Well, it's like there must be five people collecting or something in here because it's so, you know, eclectic. But that's just me. And, I mean, the motorcycles, I grew up racing motorcycles.
Well, let's take a quick look at the bikes, too.
Sure. This is a Vincent Black Shadow, which was, you know, I put a lot of miles in this bike. This is kind of the hot rod of motorcycles in the late 40s, early 50s, 1,000cc, very, very important bike. John Edgar sponsored one that ran 150 at Bonneville. These are really, really neat pieces. And then the Indian, I had to have something from my birth year. That's a 41 Indian 4. And I used to ride that around town, too. But you know what? Riding bikes now is just a little risky for me at my age. You know, I'm just not, my reactions aren't as good. And
well, traffic's a whole lot more than it ever used to be,
too,
and
there's people texting, and, you know, it's just a little risky around here.
And then I got to ask you, you got another old Indian over here.
Right. That's a 1914 Indian board tracker. And we're still putting this little garage together, and we brought this in from my home garage. But this is a 14 Indian, and they ran it right here in Beverly Hills. They had the Los Angeles Speedway, which was actually in Beverly Hills. A mile and a half board track, and this bike ran on the boards, and we have an Excelsior, so we're just trying to figure out where to put it, but for lack of a better place, we're putting it here just for the moment.
I really like this, because, don't get me wrong, all these other cars are really cool, but this is truly historical.
Yeah,
I mean, that's an early bike.
That is, 1914, and people didn't realize, but that bike, actually in 15, the Excelsior set the record, lapping the track at 100 miles an hour. Now, this bike has no brakes. I mean, it is just...
They look like bicycle tires, too.
They are. I mean, it's just...
Those guys must have been nuts running those things on those board tracks.
Yeah. And then the ones up top there, the Norton is a Norton Manx and a Matchless G45. And those were Grand Prix bikes out of the 50s and early 60s. The Norton's like late 50s, and the Matchless is a 55. So, you know, I just, I love motorcycles, and, you know, these just define beautiful proportions for me, and love looking at them.
Well, what we should tell our viewers right now is we're only halfway through, so why don't we take a quick break, and we'll move to the other side here right now. So, Ben, we'll take a quick break for the moment.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Okay, we're on the other side of the museum. I was about to call it a museum, but it's a garage,
It is a garage.
And now we're looking at a classic Mercedes here.
This,
you've got to tell us about the provenance to this car.
This is worthy of telling a little story. This was Clark Gable's car and his favorite car. And I'm going to run over here and get a picture for you to enjoy.
And what model is this exactly?
This is a 1956 or 57. They were the same. I'll put this in the front so you can compare. But that's Clark with the car.
And he owned it.
When it was delivered.
And you're saying this was his favorite?
I wouldn't have known that then. But when he passed away, his wife took this car, wrapped it in blankets. And he died in 61. I bought this in 81, so 32 years ago. But the car was completely wrapped in blankets.
Weird way to store a car.
Yeah, well, she was pregnant with John Clark Gable, mm-hmm. so she was saving this for him. Well, John is more interested in off-road and, you know, big trucks and that monster trucks and that type of thing. And this didn't do anything for him. So she sold the car. And it still has his St. Christopher's medal on the dash. The only thing non-original on this car is the leather on the seats. But the carpet is still the original carpet.
Boy, it looks new.
St. Christopher, everything is... And we took it to Pebble Beach 3 years ago. And I said, are you sure you want this? This is not like a fresh restoration. No, Bruce, you've got to bring it. So we brought it, and we actually, you know, won a nice prize. I think we took second place with it. But they appreciated the fact that it was so original.
And owned by someone of note.
Well, you know what? That's interesting, because this year at the Barrett-Jackson auction, they had Clark Gable's Gullwing. And there were a couple of young people standing by the Gullwing, and they were saying, who's Clark Gable?
No.
And the other guy said, well, I think he's a race driver. So I was saying to my friends and my family, I said, you know, if ever we wanted to sell this, this would be the time, because the next generation, Gable won't even know.
Wow.
So to me, it was pretty important. And, of course, let me show you something else here, too. This is all, we have never restored this. This is just the way it was.
Oh, my God. So we're looking at, again, fitted luggage.
Oh, yeah.
That's in actually quite good condition. You can tell it's somewhat aged. The spare tire, too, is that original?
No,
that looks awfully good for an original spare.
We put new tires on it. And so, anyways, it's a fun piece, and it was Clark's. This car here was built for Le Mans. Never ran Le Mans. It was built by a fellow named Hugh Sutherland, who was a Canadian living in Ireland.
And we should tell everyone we're looking at an E-type Jaguar.
Right.
Hardtop.
Exactly. It's a removable hardtop. And on the lightweights, they made the front end, the bonnet, the top, which they call the hood, the doors and the trunk are all aluminum. So this has about over 300 horsepower. It's basically a racing Jag. They called it a semi-lightweight. And this is another car my wife and I have probably logged 4,000 miles in. I'm just counting the 1,000-mile trips we've taken in it. But it's a great car. And to me, it's just, this thing's such a manly tool with the big wheels. And
beautiful car.
I love it.
It's amazing how long the hood is, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we all know that, but when you're standing next to it, you really notice it.
Love this car. Now, the one next to it, I guess if I had to be anything, I would be a Porsche-phile. I bought my first Porsche in 1960. And I've had a Porsche ever since. So this is a 57 Porsche, and I bought it in a basket, and it has no history, but we basically made it look like a race car. And they call them an outlaw, but I did this, I want to say, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I shipped it to Detroit and drove out Route 66 in it. I'll drive it this spring again, another 1,000-mile rally, but I'm looking, we have almost 12,000 miles in the car, you know, just in driving it. So it is another car that just loves to be driven. The car next to it is a 1967 275 GTB 4 cam. And I bought this car in 1970. It was just a couple years old, so I've had it 43 years. And it's another very original car. I mean, I've just basically... I've never done anything this car.
Is this the original paint? Because it's a brilliant
yellow.
It's
the original paint when I got it. And it is the original color. The gentleman that owned it, a fellow named Bill Doheny, he had a big estate here, a very wealthy Beverly Hills guy. He bought the car brand new, drove it to Palm Springs, and it got lightly sand pitted. So what they did, they gave it a very light sanding, and then floated an original color over it. So a little clear, very, basically just to give it shine. So the door jams are all original. I didn't even take the glass out. They just lightly fogged it with yellow to get rid of the sand pitting. But other than that, I've never touched it.
This color really pops, though.
Really,
I mean, amongst all the cars in here, man, that just pops out at you.
Yeah. And I think it's just a great color for that car. I mean, not every car looks perfect in yellow, but that one does work. So the next car is a little closer to your home. This was built for Colonel McCormick, and he owned the Chicago Tribune. And it is a one-off Duesenberg, and it was built in Pasadena. Because, you know, Duesenberg was really in Auburn, Indiana, is where they were made. But it was a chassis and an engine, and then you had a custom body built for it. I'm going to show you a picture of why this car is so special. But this is another car that had one owner for 50 years. And basically, I don't know if you're going to get a reflection on that, but you can see what a Murphy convertible coupe looks like in the black one, and then you can see the difference in this one. This one is actually 3.5 inches chopped, and the windshield's laid way back. Can you see that, John?
Yeah, I can.
Huge. I mean, the profile of this car is spectacular. And this was the car when it was brand new, when it was built in Pasadena. They had put what they call rear mounts on it. I don't know. Rear mounts, twin, you know, spares. But then somebody along the way changed it to these side mounts, which I think it looks
good. I like about this car is just the proportions. It's a huge car,
yeah.
Massively long hood,
yeah.
But very small passenger compartment.
You nailed it. That's exactly what appeals to me. And when you see it from standing back a ways, I mean, it is just... I mean, it's all...
It's what I like to call a car of heroic proportions.
I like that.
And,
I
mean, boy, this thing's spectacular.
Isn't it great?
And the detail work in it, you know, just the door handle here is almost aerospace and yet almost Art Deco at the same time.
Yeah, you got a great eye, John. Yeah, this is real special. And you see it coming at you, and it's just really chopped, you know. You see that... That windshield.
I don't know.
Stand in front of it and look straight down the hood. I think that's just one of the neat.
I don't know
looks.
If it's right, but the chop look of it.
Yeah.
The word jaunty comes to my mind.
Yeah.
And the proportions of the passenger compartment, the greenhouse, as it were, to the rest of the car is just amazing. It makes the rest of the car look so much bigger because the passenger compartment is so small. And then you've got these giant round headlamps on the front.
They're just. Well, you've just ticked every point as what appeals to me about this car. And the interesting thing is I had another one that was a twin to this car, even the same color, and it was a stock-bodied one, and it looked like my grandmother's car. And the fellow that had owned this car brought it and parked it next to mine and said, Bruce, I'm going to be selling this car. This car here it looks like it would fit in your collection. So anyway, to make a long story short, I sold my other one to Switzerland, and this one stays home. That was a number of years ago.
And now we're back to Le Mans, it looks like.
This we are. And this is the 50th anniversary of the 911 Porsche. So all the magazines are featuring 911s. And just recently, the magazines have come out. And this is arguably the most famous 911 in the world. It's an overall winner at Le Mans.
Not a class winner.
Not a class winner. Big difference. And it beat the prototypes. It's got a very colorful history with the Whittingtons. You know, they were... naughty boys, but very, very talented drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what they call a 935 K3, and the K stands for Kremer. And basically, downstairs we've got a 73 RS, which was the homologation car to call this a production car. So, you had the RS, then came the RSR, then the 934, the 934 and a half, and then the 935. So Porsche made a 935, and then the Kremers, in talking to Erwin Kremer, he said, we made 100 modifications to a Porsche factory 935, which gave us a 1% advantage, and that's all we needed. Which I know that was so cool.
That's great.
But this thing weighs nothing. You know, it's, you know, close to 1,000 horsepower. Insanely fast. We'll have this on the track in January. So we're preparing it now. We took it to Pebble Beach. We won first prize, and we took it to Amelia Island. We won first prize there, so now it's time to enjoy it.
Well, you know, you mentioned that it beat the prototypes, but this thing just about looks like a prototype itself.
Yeah, you're right. And it's so tricky because with production cars, you got to have the stock window line and the door profiles. Well, when this went through scrutineering, they wanted to stop it because they said, that's not the stock rear window. But Kremer said, oh, yes, it is, because it's down inside there. Can you see there?
Oh, my God, there's another window inside
it. So they beat the rules, you know. And, you know, if you go online, you can see some wonderful pictures of this.
Leave it to the racing guys to figure out how to reread the rule book.
That's right. You know, it's all about the edge, right?
Right.
So growing up in Southern California, and my parents did not approve of anything automotive. They didn't like cars, motorcycles, Whizzer motorbikes, none of that. So, you know, I'm a bit of a frustrated hot rodder, and I always say, You're never too old to have a happy childhood. So Bonneville has always been a place that intrigues me. So about 4 years ago, a friend of mine, Jack Rogers, offered me to drive his Camaro, which I did do. And you know, you have to get licensed and so forth. So it was a 1983 Camaro, and I went 222 miles an hour in that. And then I said I got bit by salt fever.
That wasn't fast enough.
It was fast enough, but the real Bonneville guys, in my opinion, it's like the bull riders at the rodeo.
Yeah.
You know, there's guys that race barrels and coaches and this and that, but the guys that ride the bulls, they're the real deal. And for me, driving a roadster was the real deal. So we built this car. It was actually built originally by Mike Brower and Gary Brower. And then Gary passed away. Mike sold the car. It was built by Mike Cook. So I bought it a few years ago, and we just completely redid it. It's like a new car, but it really, you know, was built originally. And in Bonneville, by the way, there's not a lot of new cars at Bonneville. They just recycle stuff. You know, they'll get an old roadster, they'll refit it. We put dry sump engine in it. We did all the fire systems over. We rebalanced the car. I mean, it's you know, ostensibly a new car.
And what engine do you have in here?
We have about a 330 cubic inch, you know, Chevy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a wonderful thing. We built it to run on alcohol and nitro, but the engine died on us before we got to the nitro. But the bottom line is I wanted to go 200 in a roadster, and we went 204. So I was able to get the job done.
That's got to be a handful in a car like this.
You know
too.
What? It really is fantastic. And I guess I'm a speed freak because people say, weren't you scared? But I mean, I love to scare myself. You know, that's just what we do, right?
It's just adrenaline rush, that's all.
Yeah, yeah. So, at any rate.
And speaking of Bonneville, boy, you got a classic here.
Yeah, this is iconic. Let me cross over here and show you. This car was on the cover of Hot Rod magazine.
1949. And we should say, this is one of the belly tank races, right?
That's right. This is a belly tank off a P-38 fighter plane from World War II. And when the guys came back from the service, they had all this new knowledge, all this new aerodynamics and aeronautic and all the state-of-the-art, you know, new knowledge, and they put it to work in cars like this. Everything's drilled, everything's done to perfection. This was Alex Exidius, 1948. He and Dean Batchelor built this car with the help of Vic Edelbrock, and Bobby Meeks did the engine. And this car is another car completely original. Everything on this car is 100% original.
Man.
The interior is original. We have repainted it. Obviously, the tires are redone, but it's just been refinished.
What a cool-looking car, too. I mean, I'm just knocked out by these.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really cool thing.
Have you driven this one?
I have driven it. I've driven everything in the room except the dragster.
And we'll get to that in a minute.
We'll get to that in a minute. But this is another wonderful icon of a car. This is, you know, considered the most important coupe in Hot Rod history. This is the Pearson brothers put this together in the late 40s on the cover of Hot Rod in 1950. And you know, when the Hot Rodders were running, they were running mostly roadsters. And they had roadster clubs. You know, they had the Road Runners and the Piston Burners and the Rod Benders. And they were all roadster clubs that ran out in the dry lakes. But this car was really the first coupe that just showed the roadsters. And it was seriously chopped, all within the rules. Because they said you had to have a 6-inch windshield, but they didn't say if it couldn't be laid back. So the profile on this car is pretty darn spectacular.
Yeah, yeah, what a look.
It's a great look. And there are models made of this. And it's just, it's one of those cars that people just love. Let me open the door for you here, too. I love, you know, in the old days, I mean, safety was not an issue. So they've got the battery right next to the...
Oh, my gosh.
Right next to the, the fuel tank, and it's pretty Spartan in there. But we've also run this up the hill at Goodwood. We've had it at the dry lakes. We've logged miles in this in anger.
And look at that. You know, it's so open in the back.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
and it's like really like driving in a tin can. I mean, the noise.
I was just going to ask. It must be super noisy inside there.
Super noisy. So the quickly on the motorcycles, growing up in a family that didn't approve of all this, the only thing I could do was play with motorcycles because I could hide those at friends' garages. So I was racing motorcycles from an early age. That Matchless is the bike of choice when I was racing. The other center bikes are drag race bikes. The top one was a one-owner bike built and raced by a fellow named Bobby Sarkeesian. And at age 12, Bobby won the NHRA championship. And
12.
His father had to lift him on it. Here's a picture of Bobby and his trophies. I don't know if I'm tilting this the right way for you. The next one down is a twin-engine Triumph.
And I've never seen any bike like that before.
Yeah, no, that's a real famous bike. Rick Rios, it was called Two-Timers. It's completely original. We really got it right from Rick, and he gave me his nitro measuring beaker and his helmet. So they took this to Europe. It was the world's fastest motorcycle for a number of years, and they took it to Europe and beat the Brits over there, too. So it turned about 160 in the corner.
Jeez.
And this is back, you know, when 160 was 160. You know how that is.
Right.
And speaking of drag racing, this is another icon. This is called the Greer Black Prudhomme Dragster. And here's turn that so maybe you can see it. That's the 64 racing annual. But they just did the movie Mongoose and McCune.
Snake and Mongoose.
Snake and Mongoose, that's
yeah.
right. Yep, sorry.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the right driver, yeah.
Got that right.
McCune and Prudhomme, right.
Yeah.
And that movie just came out this year, and we had the director in our studios earlier this year.
Yeah, with Billy Gibbons.
With Billy Gibbons, that's exactly right. So this raced in the movie and, of course,
yeah.
in the day.
That's right, and I lent it to them for the movie, and I look forward to seeing the movie. I haven't seen it yet, I must
no,
say.
No, me neither. I will see it, though.
So Tom Greer was a very wealthy engineering company owner. Keith Black was a big engine builder, and Don Prudhomme was the snake with the great reactions, and he kind of coordinated the effort, but it was a very, very successful effort. It raced 241 races and lost only four times.
Man.
In its entire
wow.
history. But before time runs out, I've got to show you that
yeah.
one of my most favorite things is this boat. And I just had this back your way. I flew into Bay City. And Doug Morin, who's a vintage hydroplane builder and restorer, restored this boat, and it's called Miss Daytona, and it's a Miller Marine. And I ran it.
Miller of Miller Indy fame?
Yes, of Miller Indy fame. And so it's a very rare engine. It's a big supercharger in the front.
What's that, a Paxman blower?
It's actually a Miller. It's all integrated.
Oh, my gosh.
So, if your folks would like to see it in action, if they go to YouTube and they put Bruce Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, Miss Daytona, there's a wonderful video of me running on the Saginaw River.
Oh, and, my gosh.
And it was great because it was a cold day. I shouldn't have been running it. There were just logs floating around. But I rung it out pretty good.
And this is beautiful. I mean, all the wood in this thing.
Oh, yeah.
So many screws holding it all together.
Oh, it is fantastic. All these beautiful bronze screws. But this is just iconic. And that picture on the wall, I think, tells a great story. That's Wilbur Shaw, three-time Indy winner.
Racing your boat.
Racing my boat. And winning in the front where he ought to be. So that's kind of the short run through it. I mean, I can go on if you like. But,
well, let's just do this one alpha that you got here, and then we'll
sure.
get to some of the questions from the audience.
Sure, happy to. This is called an Alpha TZ, or Tubolare Zagato. And in the Ferrari world, the most important Ferrari is a GTO. This, I would equate to the GTO of the Alpha world. They made 100 of these. This was the last one made. And it is just a little giant killer. It's about 1,700 cc's. And it stays right with the Ferraris and the big dogs. And
it must be super light then.
Super light. It's like, I want to say 1,700 pounds, 1,600 pounds.
Wow.
And it's a beautiful engine, four-cylinder, twin-plug head. You know, Alpha was, they ruled for a very long time. And this was one of the great cars of their
That's really cool.
Their mark.
I love all this, all different kinds of cars, plus motorcycles, plus a boat. What led you to the boat?
Well, a friend of mine owned that boat about 15 years ago, and I saw it in his barn, and I just thought, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And being one that loves L.A., and Harry Miller, of course, you know, right here in L.A., and
right.
he the genesis of the Offie, Meyer Drake, and then Bugatti actually bought his engines, and that's the genesis of the Bugatti engine.
Wow.
So the Miller connection is what really won me over.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with a fellow named Bill Coverly, who his sons were here yesterday, and he raced hydroplanes. And I just have always loved wooden boats, and I love boats. I really like going fast on the water. And so, not that I bought it because of how fast I could go, but it just, to me, it was just a nice piece of furniture to have in here. And then to be able to drive it, and I can get it out of here real quickly. So, we're ready to run it.
So, you don't only just ride your bikes and drive your cars, you run in the boat, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, the drive for me is the...
How fast would the boat go?
Well, I think they estimated that I was doing somewhere between 60 and 70.
Uh-huh.
So, this was 1929 now. So that was, you know, I would say, you know, that was enough to win.
That's great. Hey, we've got a number of questions here from the audience, Bruce.
Sure. Make them easy.
Yeah, here's an easy one. Right Knight says, is this Bruce Meyer with the Myers Manx?
That is a question. Good question. I'm not. And I get confused with Bruce Myers, M-Y-E-R-S, all the time. And when I was... my senior year of college, this was like in 62, 63, he came up with the Myers Manx, and his nephew was in my fraternity house. And so I went down to Newport Beach when he was drawing out the Myers Manx on his wall, and he wasn't even sure what he was going to name it. But people just thought I was so cool because I did the Myers Manx. But anyways, I'd love to take credit for it, but not me.
You know, if you changed the story, everybody would believe it anyway. Okay, AAH Fred says, is Bruce's garage where you're at now totally private, or can the public take a tour as well?
Sure. It is private.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. And there's enough pictures of it. I think you can probably get the picture, but thank you.
Josh by Golly says, Bruce, how does your garage compare to Jay Leno's?
And you know what? Jay's a very good friend of mine. And that's another. These are great questions. And Jay is a really good pal. And I'm out there all the time. In fact, Jay tried very hard to get me to buy one of the buildings near his so we could all have car fun together. And boy, he likes to have fun. And by the way, he is a real car guy.
Yes, he is.
But I don't think he is as hung up on the history and as I am. You know, whatever I have here has got to be absolutely real and historic and have done something, you know, remarkable. Jay is an enthusiast. If he puts a turbocharger on a 6-liter Bentley, all the better. It's very cool. Jay is way more mechanical and knowledgeable than I am. He gets in and he works on it himself. He has a great crew over there. He is a real car guy. And he drives them. He drives them to work. He lives in Beverly Hills. He goes over the canyons to work. So I guess, and Jay has hundreds of cars, and great cars. He has a Gullwing, and he just got a wonderful split-window Corvette with 900 original miles. But everybody seems to want to have Jay own their car, you know. They say, oh, I'll see somebody at a car show. I want Jay to buy this car. Well, Jay has bought a lot of cars and had a lot of cars given to him, and he's got a lot of cool stuff. But
sounds more personal.
It's more personal to me. Maybe the cars are a little more historic, and it would fit in one little corner of his. His is massive.
Okay, in fact, talking about all these cars, Larry King says, do you have all your vintage vehicles here, or do you have more?
Sure. I still have them at home. I keep them at the Peterson. The hot rods are at the Peterson for the most part. There's a wonderful museum here, the Nethercutt Collection. I've got a wonderful old Chop Baylon Merc out there from the 50s, just a cool thing. And I love the Chop Mercs. I mean, I just, every car I have, my family kids me with it, because I say, between wheels, tires, and stance, I could make a dump truck look good. So I love to sit low in the car, and I like to see the car low on the ground. And so I've got this Chop Merc that my son drove to high school, and I will probably bring that here, but that's out at the Nethercutt Collection.
That's great. Okay, Bill from L.A. says, is there one particular vehicle that's your holy grail that you want to find but have not yet caught up with?
Very good question. For a very long time, I was looking for Stu Hilborn's Streamliner, and I ran ads in magazines. One fellow said that he has it, and, you know, he's keeping it forever, but best I can tell is that it's maybe not around anymore. But to me, Stu Hilborn was a real pioneer. It's one of the first cars to do 150. So I think that would just fit nicely right there.
Okay, well, maybe we'll help you track that car down, too. Bruce Meyer, thanks so much for letting us into your garage. This is awesome, man. You got a great collection. I love your narration of the stories behind it and what went on and why you've got it. Well, really good.
It's fun to share it with enthusiasts because I feel like when you have something special, there's a bit of a responsibility to share it, you know, and I love sharing it. And it's a privilege to have you here because you're a real enthusiast. I remember that from a lot of years ago, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you, Bruce. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I want to thank all of you for having tuned in. Oh, we got one more question. Okay. I have refreshed it. Let me try one more time because we do want to get questions in. Yes, it did. Goggles Pisano wants to know, how many vintage racing events did you get to participate in this year?
So, friends of mine kid me because I'm everywhere. This year, we've probably done a half a dozen.
Oh my gosh, that's pretty good.
You know, we do the Copper State and the Colorado Grand, mostly rallies now, and, you know, some races. But really, I'm just, you know, Bonneville, a friend of mine sent me, and you probably saw that crash of that Honda. And he was just going about 200. And I just keep threatening to take that red car out and give it one last shot. But I'm retiring from Bonneville, which was a really tough thing for me to do. But, you know, you get to a certain age, you don't want to get your head shaken too badly.
Yeah, right.
You know, so if I'd have been in that little Honda, I wouldn't be here today. So I've been in a bunch, and I'm a lot of hot rod things. I do all the roadster runs and, you know, as many hot rod events as I can. Because, by the way, I think hot rodding is it's the all-American part of our hobby and our culture, and it's the hot rodders that ran Detroit and still running Detroit. It's the guys with the passion, and to me, it's as American as apple pie and baseball and everything else. And so, I love the aggressive hot rod. So I'm out there at every hot rod thing I can get to.
Okay, I've tried to end the show, but another question's come in. Okay, this is AAH guest 593. He says, if, God forbid, a fire breaks out and you can only save three of them, which ones?
Which three kids?
Yeah, that's right. Or you just let it burn down.
Oh, yeah. I would say, you know, for historical reasons, the short wheelbase should go probably first. I think that the Testarossa is the prettiest car. And let me see.
It's tough.
You know, I don't know. And probably because of the Porsche, maybe the Le Mans winner. Yeah. But it's really, really tough. And they're all so different. But and I don't have the Don Spencer car here, but that would have to be one of the first ones out, too. Mm-hmm. That's the oldest hot rod.
Yeah. Yeah, and like you said, that's what I love about seeing your car collection. It's not just one make or one genre. It's a whole bunch of stuff that's your passion. That's what's so awesome about it.
Well, thank you. And I might also mention that if you go on to YouTube again, you can put Bruce Meyer, Miss Daytona, or you can go Bruce Meyer, Never Lift. That's the way I always sign my letters, Never Lift. And if you go Bruce Meyer, Never Lift, they shows me running the Roadster there. So, you know, it's on a couple little videos.
Cool. Well, with this, we will sign off.
Okay.
Bruce, thanks a million, and want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Thanks so much.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.